The Prince and the Poisoner, the murder that rocked the British Raj. The Prince and the Poisoner sees Dan Morrison unraveling the gruesome tale of two warring brothers amidst the atmosphere of Jazz Age India. It's the story of a city and an empire on the cusp of cataclysmic change, capturing a moment when centuries-old assumptions and expressions of power became forever altered for Indians and Englishmen alike. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line from somewhere on the planet, I'm not sure if he's somewhere in the Raj or he's a West Coast, East Coast, wherever he is, but Dan Morrison is here. Dan, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling you from Washington, D.C.
Good to have you with us then in that case, and thanks for getting up so ridiculously early to be with us this morning.
Yeah, great to be here. In fact, the daylight savings threw me off, and I've been awake since 5:30. How's it with you?
Well, it's, you know, I'm on my 15th coffee, so we're good. Now then, let's look at this particular tale. How did you become interested in this particular tale about skullduggery, intrigue in the British Raj in India?
You know, it started with a very laudable goal of researching the Ganges River. And then a tangent broke off, and another tangent broke off, and another tangent broke off. And then in the British Library, I came across a stray newspaper clipping about a plague murder. And it blew up, you know, years of research that I had been doing on a scientific topic. And I put that aside, and I came to this, a murder by plague in Jazz Age Calcutta. I couldn't turn away from it.
So let's because, I mean, obviously you're talking to a British person and the Raj, and we have Jazz Age India. We have our assumptions about what it was like there. So Jazz Age India, we're talking presumably the 1920s. And was there a Jazz Age in India? Was there sort of emancipation? Were they having a funky good time in India as well as, you know, as chronicled in The Great Gatsby?
Well, you know, I think certainly from an American perspective, what do Americans know about India in the before times? You know about Gandhi, right? You know about the great nonviolence movement. You know, lines and lines of people getting their heads broken, you know, in nonviolent resistance. And that certainly happened. And that was certainly a major force in India. But at the same time, we're talking in the 1920s, 1930s, you have great changes taking place in technology, in consumer goods, and in entertainment. And people are having a good time. Things are available that weren't before. Just, you know, you have complaints about everyone in Calcutta needing a motor car. A junior professor making peanuts needs a car, and he will go into debt to get a car. The major, everyone who can get is getting. They're going to plays, they're going to movies. The restaurants of Calcutta are just as packed as they are in London and New York. There are cabaret shows, there are jazz quartets, you know, playing the Grand Hotel, playing the private clubs. And the Europeans of the Raj, you know, especially, are having a really good time.
Is it a case that the Indians though are trying to be more Western? I mean, this is a Jazz Age, but they're aping their British rulers rather than it being a particular sort of indigenous Indian experience.
You have a lot of everything across the spectrum. That is to say, it's certainly a hierarchical society with the Europeans on top, and yet you have, you know, wealthy Indians, you have tons of aristocrats with large incomes, and they're all making the most of it in the way that they're most comfortable.
And presumably, because when we're looking at the Indian aristocrats, there is huge wealth. It is a, can we call it a feudal society? Because this is going, I mean, this is basically taking on from sort of warlords and dynasties and everything like that.
It is a feudal society, man. It is classic agrarian feudalism with a man on top and a pyramid below him of people pulling every dime they can, every penny they can out of the people toiling the land. And that's what this wealth is based on. And that's what the characters in this book, that's what their wealth is based on.
So let's get on to the protagonist then, because, you know, you found this story. Set the scene if you can, Dan.
You have a, uh, a wealthy, well-off estate in a rural area, just a couple hours from Calcutta, where a family that has ruled since the days of the Emperor Akbar the Great. They're in their fourth century of controlling this patch, and you know, they've gone through trials and tribulations over the centuries. They've been conquered. They've kicked off the conquerors. But what remains is that they're really, really rich. And they have two sons. The father has died. You've got an older son and a younger son. The older son, he's with that modern thing. He's a 20th century man. He likes movies. He likes drinking. He likes women, and he likes his money. There's a younger brother who is the dutiful half brother, who is the model of rectitude and the, again, the centuries old rules of his class. You know, he's very upright, and there's a clash between them for who's going to control the estate and who's going to get the money.
And it's a tale of murder that rocks the British Raj. So is this a murder by, this isn't sort of being waylaid in a country road or hit over the head, you know, in the back of some palace somewhere, is it? This is a very sort of 20th century murder.
It is. It's, you know, fratricide's the oldest crime, and just as kings and princes on, you know, national scales, you know, would fight for power, this would happen among the aristocracy and the local landlords of India, across India, and the typical thing would be to hire goons to just outright murder your brother, or put him down in a hunting accident, something like this. What we have in our villain is a guy with vision who was most likely inspired by the works of Arthur Conan Doyle and a Sherlock Holmes story, the adventure of the dying detective, to try using microbes as his weapon. And he finds a down and out bacteriologist, and together they hatch this plan to purloin plague germs and introduce it into their victim.
This, you know, this was presumably a crime that sort of, as you said, it shook the Raj. And you're talking about the Jazz Age, and we're talking about communication and radio and you know, it's the birth of modern media. So a case like this, you know, you go back to the Victorian age and the penny dreadfuls, etc. This is like, if you like, I suppose this could be a case that is so shocking, but also can be transmitted across India, because there is wireless, there are new means of media.
Yeah, not just across India, across the empire and across the world. You know, it fed into a particular kind of hunger for Asian horrors, Asian, you know, it was always the emphasis, an Indian horror, an Asian horror, reminiscent of the Borgias, is what, you know, the newspapers would say. You know, and people ate it up.
Presumably, I mean, there was shock, and I mean, how would they? I mean, I don't want to give the whole story away, because we want people to go and buy the book, Dan. But presumably, somebody found out that the victim had been injected with plague microbes, or did the and I love this down and out biologist, you know, shuffling with a couple of dusty chest tubes. Did he sort of fess up in the end?
They did not fess up. They went to prison. They didn't stay in prison, but they went to prison, decrying, you know, crying out for their innocence, and they almost succeeded. They almost succeeded. You know, in India, when someone passes away, you know, they're typically cremated the same day, and so the assumption here is that, you know, it's Calcutta in the 30s. There are no antibiotics yet. You know, people die all the time of fevers, whether the rich and the poor are dropping in at a moment's notice. And so, you know, the thought was maybe his death could be chalked up as some kind of fever, some unknown fever, and away he'd go, and then you cash out.
And I suppose one of the great things about writing about this when discovering this is, this would be a good tale if it was in sort of late 20s, early 30s London, or you know, on Rhode Island or something. But this is the Raj. This is the opulence. This is the big parties, the Jazz Age, the feuding that make Game of Thrones look like a children's tea party.
Sure. Calcutta is the second city of the British Empire. It's wealthy. It's a center of culture, of business, of political power. And again, people are having a good time.
Here's the thought, though, because this is all taking place amongst the upper wealthy class and whatever, but there are surely the stirrings of the Indian independence movement here. There are real issues, you know, especially amongst the rural poor. So is this seen as maybe a distraction, or is it maybe a thing to say, look, we need, some people are seizing on this, saying we need to be independent because we need a new society, and this is how the upper classes are behaving.
It wasn't so much a class-based notion of this case that it would spark political issues. What you have is, yes, you've got the nonviolence resistance led by Mahatma Gandhi. You've got, you know, Nehru leading the march. Our villain and Nehru share an address. They're in the same jail at the same time, one for murder for money and the other for sedition, for advocating independence. These are two very different strains of Indian expression happening at the same time. But you also, there's a violent resistance that you don't hear about so much. And during the mid-30s, there are assassinations, there are assassination attempts, there are gunfights happening with Bengali militants and Punjabi militants in the country. Are the main lawman, a man named Edward LeBrock, who's the head of the CID in Calcutta, you know, he makes his bones, you know, he sort of makes his name in a, you know, dawn shootout with militants in a jungle hideout. These are militants who had raided an armory. You know, they're really going for it. They failed utterly, but they really went for it. You've got judges being assassinated. You've got police officials being assassinated on, you know, every couple of weeks, something's going down. That doesn't make our broad brush image of India and the Indian independence movement, in part because they failed, but it was hot and heavy. And with this trial, you have a big test for the government. There's a jury of, you know, most trials weren't jury trials then, but you have a jury trial, and the question is, will these upright middle class Bengali men, will they convict, or will they, you know, will they side with their kinsmen, essentially? And that would be, there'll be a blow for the government's prestige if they go along.
And presumably, if they didn't go along, then it would, if the trial was just a showcase, the Raj would just go, well, you see, they can't run their own affairs, so therefore we have to keep this, we have to put down any sort of insurrection, any sort of militants, and you know, we'll just carry on as normal.
Yeah, no, there was a lot on the line. The judge himself in that trial had himself been marked for death by the militants. You know, he had a target on his back.
So how do you pull this all together? And where do you, because you said you were originally writing something about the Ganges. So when you started going down this particular literary rabbit hole, where's the information come? Where do you actually find it? Do you spend a lot of time sort of in libraries in India? Just how you, because this is a fascinating tale, but not one I've come across before. And yeah, we tend to think, don't we, that, you know, the Indian independent is basically Gandhi walking the whole breadth of India and everybody flocking behind him, and that being the only spark behind the Indian independence. But this whole thing about sort of armed uprising and assassinations has been, if you like, quietly forgotten.
It has been forgotten. You have an assassination that takes place in London of a British official is assassinated in London in revenge for a massacre that took place in the Punjab. Like the despite the fact that they failed, they were deadly serious, the violent militants of the independence movement. And the sympathy for them was broad and deep. It didn't spark the masses to violent action, but the sympathy for these militants was very strong among the Indian middle class, without question. The records to get at something like this is, I all credit to the British Library, because there are only two sets of transcripts of that trial, and one is missing in Calcutta, and the other is in the archives of one of the judges, and his family donated it to the British Library. And so for years, whenever I passed through London, I would steal a couple days to, you know, get into that beautiful building and start and photographing page after page, photographing thousands of pages. From there, I went into the Indian National Library, different archives, private archives, newspaper archives, you know, really worm-eaten volumes of medical texts and you know, college directories at the Calcutta School of Tropical Medicine. You know, it took a lot of digging to find some of the grit. You know, just the climate there alone is not, it just doesn't agree with paper documents.
But it must be great to get the, because if you get those primary accounts, those, you know, falling apart bits of paper, then you have unlocked, haven't you? You suddenly on a time, you know, and first primary source material is a time machine, and you are looking at the records and the reports, and in some cases the personal letters of people who were there, and you can be transported from a dusty room in the British Library to the more exotic climes of India and the Raj.
You can't beat it. You know, I got the handwritten memoirs of the Calcutta police commissioner's wife, you know, and she's living in a different world from others. She said, "We loved Calcutta. You could play any game you wanted."
Yes, the Raj experience was quite something for the British, but quite obviously something entirely different for the Indians. What do you hope that people will take discover, because this is fascinating. I hadn't come across this case at all, and I hadn't come across this the whole armed uprising and assassinations narrative as well. So what do you hope that people will learn from The Prince and the Poisoner?
Oh, thanks. It's a ripping true crime tale, but it's sort of the spine for a broader story about a place that's just on the cusp of insane cataclysmic change, right? It's a world between, you know, mustard gas and the atomic bomb, and they don't know what's coming. The British don't know. The Indians don't know. The world's about to change. The World War II is coming. Independence is coming. Partition is coming, and with it, all everything will shift.
The book is called The Prince and the Poisoner, The Murder That Rocked the British Raj. It's by Dan Morrison, who we're speaking to today. Dan, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to find more about you and about the book?
At the moment, I would say Instagram, where the handle is DM South Asia, DMSOUTHASIA.
DM South Asia. And you can also order the book via our own virtual bookstore. This book is called The Prince and the Poisoner, The Murder That Rocks the British Raj. It's by Dan Morrison. Dan, thank you so much for getting up so early to speak to us. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Yeah, it's been terrific. Thanks for having me.